This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Thanks for being with us on Think Tank. I am Mike Russell, right alongside Dr. Mike O'Neill. The topic of illegal immigration has been widely discussed for years, especially here in the Ground Zero state of Arizona. But how much do we know about the people that are involved? How do they get here? How do they survive after they get here? This week's Think Tank will not rehash any of the well-known arguments on either side of the issue. We have heard all of those before many times over and over again. It will, however, attempt to put a human face on what is often considered only the abstract.
Our first guest today is an award-winning author and journalist, Terry Green Sterling. Terry spent over a year living with and interviewing a wide range of illegal immigrants and learning the answers to many of these questions. She's going to share some of these with us today and tell us stories. And we will also have the opportunity to meet two of the people chronicled in her book, Illegal. We'll hear some of their stories directly, and I think you'll find what they all have to say to be fascinating, and some of it to be unexpected and surprising. Now, welcome, Terry.
Thank you.
I've known Terry for, I think, 30-plus years. She regularly won awards as the Journalist of the Year, which was a peer-awarded prize back from her years in the New Times. In fact, I remember having been interviewed by her back in that period. And I don't remember the topic, but I remembered one thing, is that the interview was demonstrably more thorough than any other than I'd ever been through. You should also know, in terms of putting her her work in context, she's from a Southern Arizona ranching and mining family. And Terry, welcome to the Think Tank.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So tell us, how did you go about writing the, what gave you the idea for the book, and how'd you go about writing it?
Well, actually, the idea for the, and they asked me to write a book about immigration, and when I looked at all the books on immigration that had been written, there were no books on immigrants in Phoenix, undocumented people who lived in Phoenix. There were a good many books on politics. There were books on, you know, the crossing from Mexico into Arizona, the crossing the border stories, but there were no there was no book that just focused on the undocumented people who lived in Phoenix. So I became fascinated by this secret, really a secret world that I knew nothing about. At the time that I began to research the book, and these numbers still hold true, there were approximately, the estimates of unauthorized immigrants in Arizona range between 275,000 and 500,000, with the average guess that about 400,000 undocumented people lived in Arizona. And since Phoenix was sort of the eye of the hurricane in terms of controversy, in terms of the immigration controversy, but also the biggest population center of undocumented immigrants in Arizona, I had the goal of entering the world and the homes, and most important, the hearts and souls of the undocumented immigrants in the Phoenix area. And I chose to tell the stories of some of the most interesting people I met after following them for a year or so.
And you have a lot of interesting stories. I thought this book was a cross between the Grapes of Wrath for the human pathos, but it also had elements, if you're an old Steinbeck fan as I am, of Cannery Row. There were a lot of very, very colorful figures, and they're not all the same. And I wonder if you could start us out by telling us about a couple of the more interesting and or surprising people that you encountered.
Okay. First, just one quick thing that I wanted to say. When I wrote the book Illegal, I wanted to write stories, warts and all. I didn't want these to be whitewashed stories. I wanted them to be full, rich, you know, stories of people who lived in Phoenix during this time. I wanted to know their hopes, fears, goals, sins, and I wanted to know what their mistakes were and whether they triumphed by their from their mistakes or whether they were destroyed by them.
Okay, let's hear some of those.
Okay. One of the things that I did was I entered the agricultural world, and I learned that every time that, and I still think of this when I go to the grocery store, every time I get a carton of milk, the dairy industry in Arizona has a good many, at the time I wrote the book, had a good many undocumented employees. So I got to know a family in the outskirts of Phoenix who were a dairy family. And they were what we call a mixed status family. This is a very common family in the undocumented world where some of the family members have papers and some do not. And there was a sort of resentment sometimes, or a tension between children who were undocumented and children who were not undocumented, which was fascinating to me. But the other thing that I learned was the level of skill that the dairymen, that the undocumented dairymen have. And if you'd like, I could read you a little bit about the skill level. I can't really tell you per se.
But, we got about 2 minutes before the break, so keep it concise.
So the dairyman was Eduardo, and I'll just read you a little bit about sort of his skill level and what he did at the dairy. Eduardo had climbed as high as he could in the dairy. He was the de facto veterinarian, a prestigious position. He understood the science behind dairy cow diets, how to proportion maize, cottonseed, silage, barley, millet, DDD, alfalfa, green almond leaves, grapefruit, oranges, and cantaloupe. Eduardo was also in charge of the cow infirmary, a lean-to near the corrals with a refrigerator full of medicines and carefully kept logs with Spanish headings in uneven handwriting. And Eduardo was actually like a veterinarian in that, yet he was only making $24,000 a year, but his skill level matched that in many ways of a dairy veterinarian. So they didn't have to call the vet. He already had the medicines. He already took care of the cows. One of the things that I learned was that immigrants come to the United States. The overall reason is very often economic, but underneath there are a lot of different reasons. Family reunification. One of the immigrants that I profiled was gay, and he was tired of enforced heterosexuality in his world of Mexico. And so there are a variety of different stories, all of which surprised me.
We're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna come back more with Terry Green Sterling, author of the book Illegal. We're peeling back layer by layer this world that you have not seen or that doesn't get a lot of press with regards to the illegal immigration debate. We are going to hear from people in this book coming up next.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Thanks once again for being with us. Our special guest today on The Think Tank is Terry Green Sterling, author of the book Illegal. She just gave us an amazing insight into a world that we seldom talk about, we seldom think about. And alongside of me, as always, Dr. Mike O'Neill.
Well, welcome back, Terry. I've been corrected by you in terms of the use of the word legal, illegal. Now, I know in this culture, that's a very, very powerful word because we are instinctively a law-abiding people. And when you describe anything in terms of illegality, especially if that's all you hear, it connotes a negative thing, certainly. And I would like to ask you your problems with the use of the word illegal as a noun, even though you used it as the title of your book, which was very powerful.
It's an irony. I use the word illegal as the title of my book because it's a pejorative term. It's a term that we use to sort of put people in a box and dehumanize them. I don't use the word in my writing unless I'm, using a direct quote from somebody else, but it's a very pejorative term. And the Associated Press style book recently took the word out of its style book. That's the newspaper style book that most newspapers
file.
And the rationale was that it's a very offensive term. A Nobel Peace Peace Prize winner and Auschwitz survivor, is credited with first saying what good people on both sides of the nation's immigration debate inherently understand, and that is that no human being is illegal.
Well, you know, I thought about this, and I thought of this an almost trivial personal example, but let me relate it to you. I'm a habitual speeder almost every time I drive. What image does that come out? Unsafe, reckless. Well, I think I'm a safe driver. No accidents in over 40 years, zero. I won't tailgate. I won't weave in and out. I am, however, a type A personality, you know, the group of people who built civilization. And so I'm in a hurry. Now, if you use the word speeder to describe me, it's first of all, when you reduce anything to one word, it misses the point. And when that's all you hear, if that's a negative, it can connote a whole lot of other stuff that isn't. But I also get the point of an adjective versus a noun. It's not a characterization of the person. It may be a description of one act or one incident, but we're missing the whole picture of a life.
And it's dehumanizing, yeah. And offensive. And ironically, that's why I used it as the title of my book again, because that's what people chose to classify millions of other people.
In the spirit of trying to understand more about some of these folks, we have one of them here. His name is Carlos, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I wonder if you could share with us a little bit of your life story. Tell us about where you were born, how you got here, and we'll go from there.
First of all, I want to say thank you for letting me share my story.
Thank you for being here.
I come from Mexico City. I'm born in Mexico City. I crossed the border in 1997.
Where did you cross?
Oh, Nogales, uh-huh. Arizona. I crossed, I jumped the wall.
Uh-huh. How tall was the wall back then?
I don't know, 12, uh-huh. 12 feet.
Wait, I thought they said if we built a wall, it would all be okay now. No, no, you can jump a wall. I like. All right, good job, Carlos.
12 feet, that's athletic.
Yeah, so that's hard. That's hard for me.
And did you do it right in the urban area then?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sorry.
It's okay. So tell us a little bit, what motivated you to come here?
To get a better future for my family, my parents. That time I wasn't have a family, just my wife and I. Uh-huh. But basically my parents.
Your wife came with you at the time?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we crossed the border.
So what? Can I just cut in here a little bit and say that I met Carlos and Sandra. I was able to meet them because at the time that I met them, they had just been released from prison, where not prison, but immigration detention center, because they had both been ensnared in a raid, a Sheriff Joe Arpaio workplace raid.
Uh-huh.
And so it was an interesting story because they have one daughter who's an American citizen. And they both worked at the same car wash, and Carlos had worked at the car wash for many, many, many years. So I was really interested in getting to know this family, and I think you'll find lots of surprising things in the book about Carlos and Sandra. But Carlos, one of the things is, what's happened, how do you view yourself now, your situation now? How do you view Americans now as opposed to then? And why are you still here? Why aren't you deported?
Well, my situation is it's not clear now, because I have to see a judge, immigration judge, to he decide if he let me stay or I have to back to Mexico. So my situation is not clear now. I have a permit to work, but
it's a temporary permit.
It's a temporary. Yeah.
I understand you got the permit because there's legal action pending, and as a result of that, you get a Social Security card in the interim.
Yeah.
Is that a fair?
Right.
And how many years did you work at the car wash?
I have been working on the car wash for 16 years.
And you're the what's your job?
I'm the supervisor for the whole
And
people.
I understand your wife at least used to. Does she still work at the same car wash?
Yes, uh-huh. We are. We so are in the same place. She has been working for 12 years. So the reason we cross the border is to get a better life for us. Now I have a children, two girls I have. It. So I want my girls go to school, get a degree, go to the university, you know, and...
Would you say you have that at this point? Do you have a better life?
I have a better life. Mm-hmm. I have a better life.
Tell us a little bit about what you've done since you've been here.
Did you buy a house? Did you travel?
Yeah. In Mexico, it's hard to travel. It's hard to get a good job. Instead, in United States, I'm already know California, Vegas, Colorado, Washington, D.C. I visited most of these places, and that's beautiful. And I would like to travel many other towns and states.
We're gonna take a quick break, and I tell you, we will continue with more of these amazing stories. Really the face of immigration. When we get back, you're listening to Mike Russell, Dr. Mike O'Neill. This is The Think Tank.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Mike Russell along with Dr. Mike O'Neill. You can catch him at MikeO'Neill.org, his blogs, political issues, or you can, his work email. It's O'NeillResearch.com. We are entrenched in a very powerful message here on the state of immigration here in the great state of Arizona. And our next guest is Angelica Hernandez.
Angelica, welcome. My understanding is you came here when you were 8 years old with your mom.
Yes, I came to the U.S. in 1998. I was actually going to turn 9. I ended up getting here on my birthday. So it was kind of a present and good timing in a sense because, you know, crossing the border, we were coming to reunite with my dad. So he had been here working for a few years.
You're eight. Do you actually remember the crossing?
Yes, I do. And
tell us a little about that.
I think the hardest thing is just walking and not knowing when it's going to end, you know, not knowing how close you are or what's going to happen.
And you were out in the desert, as I recall.
Yeah. Yeah, we crossed through the desert, I do have to give it to my mom that, you know, she had a lot of courage to do that and come with myself and my sister, who's only a year older than me. So, you know, just coming through the desert, I remember walking for a very long time, and we even had to stay and sleep, you know, in the middle of the night because we had been walking for so long. So it was kind of our break. And the thing I remember the most is, you know, just having to lay down and my mom putting out her arms and just holding my sister and myself on each arm and just, you know, praying that no coyote, no snake would come out and hurt us. So I think that's the biggest memory that I have from
vivid.
Being in the desert. Yeah.
Certainly vivid. And you came here to reunite your mother and your dad. How'd that work out?
Well, it didn't work out so well. They ended up getting a divorce. And so my mother being here by herself, you know, she didn't have any other family. She didn't have any close relatives here. But even then, she knew that coming here was going to give us a better life. And, you know, in Mexico, I don't remember that we struggled. I don't remember that, you know, we ever had to worry about not having food or a roof over our heads. But, you know, she knew that, that the United States was where you went to follow your dreams. Uh-huh. So even after the separation, she decided to stay. She had to work two jobs as a single mother. And, you know, we knew.
What did she do?
She has been working on and off in like different factories. Uh-huh. So whenever it would get tough, you know, she had to change jobs. But that's the amazing thing that they always knew that she was just such a hard worker that she never had to struggle to find a job.
Now, what about yourself? I understand you did rather well in school.
Yeah, so I, you know, taking what my mom had always told us and valuing education, I went to Carl Hayden Community High School. I was really involved in the robotics program. I was president of the National Honor Society. I was, you know.
Let me back up for a minute. You mentioned that robotics team.
Yeah.
A lot of us have read about that.
Yes.
This is the team that faced off against college students from MIT and beat them.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
So I was really inspired when that happened, and I knew that that was something that was going to be important for me to get involved in. And I've always, you know, sought out different opportunities to be able to get to where I want to be. And the robotics program really, really helped me get there. Not only did I get to meet amazing mentors, but I also was inspired to go into engineering because of that program. Mm-hmm.
And you then studied engineering at ASU.
Yeah. So coming out of high school, I had a full ride, but Proposition 300 passed in 2006, and it was going to be implemented in 2007.
Now, the initial full ride was funded through whom? Was that state?
It was it was statewide, and okay. Also some private funding. So I had numerous scholarships.
In review, Prop 300 for the listeners that don't remember Prop 300.
Prop 300, as I recall, basically said that that people who are undocumented not only cannot get state aid, they have to pay out-of-state tuition. Is that fair?
Got it. Okay.
That's correct. So, you know, graduating from high school, I was all set. I had my scholarships. I knew, you know, I was ready to start. And then it was going to be implemented in 2007, and that's when I graduated. So
from high school.
From high school. So, you know, now I had to think about what I was going to do
so
to be able to afford.
You're looking, your aid is gone and your tuition just went from $6,000 to $18,000.
Exactly. So it was just such a big feeling of uncertainty to not know if I was going to get to go to school. And it was something that I had been working for so hard. And, you know, I put in the work, and I've always been a believer that if you put in the work that, you know, you're going to get to where you want to be. But, you know, fortunately, I was able to find private funding to get still all of my tuition covered and even housing to stay on campus.
And let's plug, who was the source of that funding?
That was, some of the funding was coming through, President Michael Crow created a private fund uh-huh. for the undocumented students that were currently at ASU. So what he thought was, there's all these students that are currently attending an ASU and all of these other students that are accepted. So we don't want to just leave them halfway. We need to take them down, you know, through the pipeline. So he created a scholarship. Obviously, it backlashed. So after 1 year of funding, it was discontinued. So, you know, every year, you know, even though I was able to get funding to go to school, every year we didn't know if we were going to have that funding. So as an undocumented person, you learn to take it one day at a time, a week at a time, a month at a time, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future.
That's got to make it tough to stay motivated if you don't know.
It does. And that's why you see a lot of people that are so discouraged and don't have any hope to keep going. All of the younger students who are dropping out of high school who, you know, think, well, you know, even if I graduate, I can't use my degree. Mm-hmm. So why should I go? But, you know, being undocumented puts so many challenges in front of you, but at the same time, it makes you work harder. So I don't, you know, I feel fortunate to be in this position, even though that may seem strange. because it has made me a better person.
And you did well, did you not?
I did. So in 2011, I graduated from Arizona State University. I graduated at the top of my class, and I got my degree in mechanical engineering. After that...
That's not an easy field.
It's not. It's not. And there's not that many...
As an ex-college professor, I can tell you, I know there are fields that you can BS your way through, and there are other fields you can't. And mechanical engineering is one of the latter.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So I definitely had to work really hard and stay motivated.
Okay, one last quick question. Where are you now?
I'm currently pursuing my master's degree in civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University.
I don't even know where to go from there. This is it turned from a tearjerker into this was a movie in 10 minutes. This was a blockbuster movie just in 10 minutes alone. You're here on the Think Tank. We are looking at the human side. We are looking at the faces of this ongoing immigration debate right here in the state of Arizona. A very special guest, Terry Green Sterling, is going to stay on. Both our guests, Carlos and Angelica, will stay on through the break as well. Mike Russell, Dr. Mike O'Neill, this is The Think Tank. We get back to it next.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. Mike Russell, Dr. Mike O'Neill, MikeO'Neill.org, O'NeillResearch.com are his two websites. We are entrenched in, as I mentioned, the human side of the immigration debate.
Angelica, you modestly, I think, slid across your level of accomplishment. You described it as top of your class, but you were, in fact, valedictorian, were you not?
Yes, of the mechanical engineering department.
And you are now a graduate student at Stanford. So,
yes.
So these stories have different ending. The story for your sister, however, was a little bit different. I wonder if you'd tell us about that. She's a year older than you. She came over at the same time. If you were 8, she must have been 9 or 10.
Yeah, she actually turned 10 when we came here. And for her, I feel that she has made so many sacrifices. She was the one that was going to put the example there for me. So when I graduated from high school, she was already attending Arizona State University. She was pursuing a degree in psychology and sociology. And for her, it was a little bit tougher because she was staying back home. You know, I was all on campus, but a lot of the responsibility to help back at home kind of fell on her. So, you know, I admire her so much and her strength and perseverance to keep going. When she was going to Arizona State, she also was pregnant, and you know, you think a lot of people may not get through or get fall behind, but she didn't. You know, she kept going to school until she had her baby, and she graduated in 2010, and she ended up double majoring in psychology and sociology. So for her right now is just the difficulty of not having the experience that she would have had if she had a work permit or if she had, you know, the opportunity to do an internship.
So she has a college degree, but there are work permit issues, are there not?
Yes. So, I mean, currently for a lot of the dreamers, you know, that we're able to apply for work authorization. But the difficulty now is, you know, a lot of us are graduates. A lot of us, you know, have our degrees. Maybe it's been a year, maybe it's been 2 years. You go apply for a job and you have that gap. What did you do in those 2 years? You didn't do an internship. You don't have any other experience.
And just so we can explain for the audience who may not all connect with it, the Dreamer is a group of people who were given, in effect, a temporary reprieve. And correct me if I get any of this wrong, by the president, that says, if you were brought here as a young child, if you are either going to college or I think have gone to the military, you have to graduate from high school, have a good, clean, non-criminal record, you get a reprieve of a couple of years and you get the right to work, I believe, during that period. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's correct.
So you are a dreamer and your sister as well?
She is, yes. Okay. So we both applied for work authorization. Work authorization is only for 2 years. So like I was saying before, you know, you take it one step at a time and you take what you can get at the time. But, you know, just the difficulty of finding a job and wanting to do so much, but being limited by not having a Social Security number.
So your sister does have a temporary Social Security number. What is she doing right now?
She's currently still at home. She's been applying to different places. But one of the biggest challenges here in Arizona is that she can't get a driver's license. So a lot of places where you go apply, they ask you for a state ID. And she can't get it simply because they specifically put a restriction for a lot of the DREAM Act students who qualified for this deferred action not to get a driver's license.
In Arizona. Yeah. Okay. Difficulties. Okay, Terry, you and I were talking about Carlos's situation, and you wanted to sort of put that in a little bit of context, and feel free to talk to him.
Okay. Well, first of all, just sort of overall, one of the interesting things about sort of the immigrants that I interviewed, some of them who had been put in removal proceedings or deportation proceedings like Carlos, is that while you're fighting this battle in court, which you have to pay for with many thousands of dollars, while you're fighting this battle in court, you get a temporary Social Security number, and you also get to drive and to work. Everything you do, you're temporarily, you have what they call legal presence in the United States. And the only cohort that doesn't get to drive who does have legal presence in the United States now are the Dreamers. So that's kind of interesting.
Carlos can drive, but Angelica cannot. Is that correct?
Right. But Angelica, yeah. I think you have a driver's license from California.
From California.
Because
okay,
she's going
law.
To Stanford.
Okay.
But So one of the what you hear in these voices and what I heard over and over again when I entered this world and wrote this book, Illegal, is that there's this overwhelming tension of not knowing what is going to happen. You heard it in Carlos's voice. You heard it in Angelica's voice, because nothing is certain. And when you have families, as most undocumented families or families with one undocumented person, you have very often American citizens. For example, Angelica's brother is an American citizen. And Carlos's two children.
Because I presume he's younger and was born here?
He was born here. And Carlos's two kids are American citizens.
Because
so maybe
they also were born here.
Maybe you can talk about your thoughts about what will happen, because you have a court case coming up in July.
Yeah. Well, like I said, my court is in July, but it's not clear. So
you don't know what happens in July?
I don't know what happens.
You could get deported in July?
Probably.
And you own a home.
And you're a homeowner?
Yes.
Two kids who are American citizens?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the home's not so much an issue. There's two children involved and your wife. Does your wife have a court date as well?
Yes.
Okay, and is it the same time?
At the same time.
Okay.
That's why I'm worried about my kids. If we deport her, I don't know what I have to do with my kids. Live with somebody else on United States or take with me to Mexico.
You don't know what you do.
I don't know.
And your kids are how old now?
The older, she has 13, and the little one, 3 years old.
Uh-huh. Let me ask Angelica, that we were talking in the break about a variety of things, one of which is that how important is citizenship as opposed to permanent residence? Does that matter?
I mean, I think what a lot of people are looking for is being able to work, you know? They have invested so much in building a future here in the United States. And if you were to ask my mom, you know, she would be comfortable with just being able to work,
uh-huh,
and still providing for her family. So I think, of course, to me, you know, citizenship is important. But I think the first step and what a lot of people are just waiting for is being able to get a social security number, work authorization, and being able to work legally.
To know where you're going to live in 6 months.
Exactly.
Some stability, some sense of permanence. Carlos, is that fair for you? Is that really what matters? Does citizenship matter, or is that just beyond the pale of something you could think about now?
Well, that's important for everyone to get a citizenship, because if not, you are on risk to deported. Uh-huh. So that's why it's important to get a citizenship. You know, if I get my citizenship, I don't worry about, I can buy a home, I can buy whatever I want.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you each, you've been through an awful lot and a lot of, I mean, a lot of negative and some positive as well. On Toto, I just want, from the gut, how do you feel about this country now?
For me, I feel blessed. I'm really thankful. You know, I'm thankful because we came here following our dreams, and you know, even though there's so many challenges, there's still opportunities. You just have to work a little bit harder to find them. So for me, I know it's discouraging a lot of the times, and it's having to put that extra work. But at the same time, you know, I love this country, and this is the only place that I know that I remember, and I can't imagine having to go back to Mexico.
I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing some very, very human stories.
Two amazing, amazing stories. Carlos jumping a wall to coming with a wife, two kids, owning a home, a great job, and then Angelica coming through the desert, not knowing where she was, all the way to graduate school at Stanford, all wrapped up in an amazing book by Terry Green Sterling called Illegal, which is available now. Thank you to all three of you. This is The Think Tank. I'm Mike Russell, Dr. Mike O'Neill. We'll see you next week.